Hello and welcome to another Texans Talk podcast. I'm your host for today, Anthony Wood, and with me today is voice of the Houston Texans himself, Mr. Mark Vandermeer. Mark, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Great, Anthony. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us. It's going to be an absolute pleasure today. So, as you may have heard, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke to Jason Bell, former Houston Texan. Obviously, he was there for the very first regular season game when they beat the Dallas Cowboys back in 2002. And you've been there from the beginning as well, so I figured this was a very good opportunity for us to look back at the first Texans playoff win back against the Bengals in 2011. What are your sort of prevailing memories from this game? What could you possibly summarize that campaign for us in briefly for us as well?
Well, there was the season and there was the game, you know, because the season was interesting. It started off 3-3. They went on a 7-game winning streak. And during that streak, they lost quarterback Matt Schaub, which was a devastating blow at the time. They had just beaten Tampa Bay on the road. Everything was looking good. That morning after that win, that was the fourth win in a row in that streak. And that morning, they were the top seed in the AFC with a long way to go, but they were looking good. But that afternoon, Monday afternoon, I'll never forget, we got the news that Schaub was out for the season and he had a Lisfranc injury. So somehow he broke his foot or whatever, the bones in his feet that contribute to that injury during a quarterback sneak of all things. And it was, interestingly enough, Albert Haynesworth, who he collided with, and Haynesworth is now in the news for needing a kidney. Just sort of a random side note
yes.
there. But Schaub was lost, and they had Matt Leinart as a backup who had played with Arizona. He was a high draft choice. And we thought, okay, you have Matt Leinart, so let's see if this can work. Well, they had a bye to get ready for Jacksonville the next game. Leinart gets hurt in the first half of that Jacksonville game, and T.J. Yates comes in. He's a third stringer, fifth-round draft choice. He was a rookie that year. And they survived that Jacksonville game. Yates didn't play badly, didn't play great, but they were so dominant defensively that it didn't matter. And the rest is kind of history. I mean, TJ got them on a little bit of a roll there because he beat Atlanta at home. He beat Atlanta. It was 17-10. It was a low-scoring game, but he played well in that game. The defense was just really coming around, though. Wade Phillips in his first year as coordinator. J.J. Watt was still a rookie. He had not yet blown up to the status that he would. It was really during the playoffs where he would get going. But they were able to beat Atlanta. Then they beat the Bengals on the road the next week to clinch the division for the first time in team history. And that was Yates throwing for 300 yards, and they had this incredible drive with a couple of minutes to go. T.J. Yates, no timeouts. He made some key throws. Owen Daniels had a couple of good catches. Yates had a 17-yard scramble. Then he would eventually hit Kevin Walter for the game winner to enable the Texans to win. And they would watch in the locker room as the Titans would lose to New Orleans, and they would clinch the division for the first time ever. And it was really a special day. It was an unforgettable day in team history. I'll never forget that. And then they would lose the next three games on the way out. Now, two of those losses, they still had some stuff on the line. They could have gotten a first-round bye, possibly, with some help and things like that. But they lost to Carolina, then to Indy on the road, and then they had a home game with Tennessee that didn't mean anything. So they let Yates play for a series, and he went 4-for-4. And then Jake DeLome finished it off. They actually almost won that game. They went for two late because they didn't want to go to overtime. They scored a touchdown. In normal circumstances, you would have kicked an extra point to go to overtime, but they didn't need the win, so to speak. So it could have been an 11-win season very easily for them. But it was a 10-win season. Then they had the playoff game. And the playoff game, afterwards I said, this is the perfect day. It was really a perfect day because the crowd was crazy. I mean, it was the first playoff game. It was a madhouse. And they just got it going. It was a 10-10 game, as I recall, and it was close to the half, and that's when Watt had the pick six off Andy Dalton, which is really the greatest play in the history of the franchise.
Yeah,
J.J. Watt at close range, being able to snare a pass and bring it to the end zone. And that was a few things. I mean, it enabled you to say, all right, they're going to take control of this game now, the defense. I mean, when you score like that, it's really devastating to the opponent. Andy Dalton was a rookie himself. It was really something to see. And the roof almost blew off the building. And you just felt like there's no way they're going to lose this game now. And it was really the birth of J.J. Watt as a superstar in the NFL. I mean, talk about a playoff debut. And it was Andre Johnson's playoff debut. I mean, he had been around since 2003, and he caught a touchdown pass in the second half. And Arian Foster's playoff debut, and he scored a touchdown on a tremendous run. I mean, Arian Foster was peaking at that point. They had a great line. Defense was ranked second in the league. They were firing on all cylinders, and it was fun to watch. It was a great afternoon, no doubt.
I mean, what else is there to ask at the end? I mean, that was a fantastic summary. I must say, your memory is absolutely astounding. I have to admit, I'm very jealous.
I've been around since the beginning, so I don't remember everything in life, but I remember just about everything about the Texans, and I could probably go through each season and tell you pretty much game by game what happened. I don't remember final scores to everything, but I can pretty much go through every season of the franchise game by game because, you know, being in the booth and describing everything and then talking about it all week long, because I've always been on the radio all week long discussing the Texans and then doing the games on Sunday from the booth. So 2011 was a remarkable season, and it was sad because Matt Schaub getting hurt meant that you probably weren't going to go to the Super Bowl. And you know, we didn't really think of it that way. We knew it was a really big blow, but Yates was hanging in there. He actually played well. The next week, though, going to Baltimore, that's where it got really dicey because the Ravens were so good then, and Joe Flacco was really coming around as a star in this league, and their defense has always been good. And you just knew that that was going to be a tough task, and the Texans didn't help themselves because Jacoby Jones had a muffed punt in that game early that led to a touchdown, and Yates threw three picks. I mean, you have four turnovers in that game. You still only lose by one score. I mean, had Schaub played, you just get the feeling that they would have won that one. Now, AFC Championship game, who knows? You know, maybe you win it, maybe you don't. But with a healthy Schaub, I like their chances to at least get to the AFC Championship game. And this is Houston, where the Oilers never went to a Super Bowl. They've been to two AFC Championship games in 78, 79, and that's it. So this year is you look at it, it's the 40th anniversary of the Oilers going to the AFC Championship game for the second consecutive year. And the Texans have been to the divisional round a couple of times, but never able to, three times, and they've never been able to get to the AFC Championship game. So you want to at least somehow get to do that, and we'll see if they're able to do it this year.
Well, here's the question that comes straight to mind for me, at least. I mean, Andre Johnson said a couple times that he felt this was the year. If they were ever going to make it to the Super Bowl, had Schaub stayed healthy, this really would have been the year. Do you agree with that sentiment? Do you really think that had he been healthy, the Texans could have made the Super Bowl in the 2011 season?
I think that what's interesting about that year is, like I said, Watt was just in the playoffs, he had erupted, right?
Yeah.
He was starting to sack the quarterback at a J.J. Watt like pace. Brooks Reed played well. He was a rookie that year. The defense was really coming around. Brian Cushing was healthy. See, in 2012, they had a better record, and Schaub was healthy. But Cushing got hurt in week five, and I think Cushing to those teams was so crucial. And not that they didn't have good players without him, but Cushing was just such a part of things in the middle there that if you didn't have him, and they didn't have him for the bulk of 2012, it was trouble. I mean, you look at what happened in 12 down the stretch. They started out 11-1 in 2012, but they lost three of their last four. And one of those losses was a huge, devastating blowout loss. It became a blowout in the second half against the New England Patriots on Monday Night Football. That was supposed to be a Texans coming out party. Okay, changing of the guard in the AFC. Finally, Houston gets its shot. 11-1, you go in there. Now, had the Texans, so they lose that game, had they won at least one more game down the stretch, so after that Patriots game, they're able to win the division, but because they beat the Colts at home, but what they couldn't do is beat Minnesota or Indy, and they just had to beat one of those teams in order, Indy again, because they beat Indy at home, they had to beat Indy on the road. or beat Minnesota at home, and that wasn't a very good Viking team. If they were able to do that, they would have had home field advantage throughout. This is 2012. They, at home, they were really difficult to beat. I think they could have done it had they won one of those games, but they didn't. They were starting to slip a little bit. They did beat the Bengals in the playoffs again that year, but they went up to New England in the playoffs, and they just got drilled in the second half. It was 17-13 at the half, and then it just slipped away in the second half. So I think Andre's right that the thing about that year, about 2011, is the defense was better, and the offense, they were really clicking well. With Schaub, I think they would have run the ball well with Arian Foster. They would have found a way to at least get to the AFC Championship game. I cannot say, if you're playing the Patriots, especially in New England, I cannot say that the Texans would have definitely gotten the Super Bowl. I just can't say that.
Yeah.
But the difference is this. If Schaub's healthy, they probably win the games they won with Yates, and maybe they win one or two of those other ones because they lost three in a row to exit the regular season. They probably win at least one more game. So maybe they beat Carolina and or Indy on the road that year. That was a bad Indy team. They were 2-14, and one of the two wins was against the Texans with Dan Orlovsky playing on a Thursday night. I mean, that was ridiculous to lose that game on the road, but they did. I love Dan, but you know he'll tell you that that was a close game, and he actually engineered a game-winning drive for the Colts that night. And I don't think that would have happened if you had Schaub. It would have been out of reach. So yeah, I think your chances would have been really good. Those 2 years, there were some great times, great moments, but. And I think in 2011, we all were fine with the end result based on the fact that Schaub was hurt. Okay, you went to Baltimore, you took your shot, you lost. But I know the team didn't feel good about it because, again, four turnovers. You feel like if you're just able to hang on to the ball, you probably win that game and you go at least one step further. Maybe not the Super Bowl, though.
Well, here's my question for you then. Obviously, you mentioned the importance of Brian Cushing specifically when he was out in that 2012 campaign. I mean, he obviously had a big part to play in that locker room. He was a team captain for quite some time. He was a leader on that team from day one, pretty much. He's a very vocal guy, and obviously he's a coach there now. I mean, do you think he really was the heart of that defense throughout those few years there when they were really dominating? Do you think that was what they really missed? Was it his leadership more than anything?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, you know, because JJ, even in 2012, as dominant as he became, was still in his second year. Cushing was a veteran at this point. He was 2009, and so, you know, it was his first year. So he really is a leader. He's an inspirational guy. He has a rub-off effect on the rest of the defense. And, you know, I look at, like, in 2011, they still had D'Amico Ryans. You know, and D'Amico Ryans was maybe he wasn't playing as great as he could have in 2011 because it was kind of a different feel to it with it was a different feel because he had gone out with an injury in week 6 the year before in 2010. So he's coming back from injury. He wasn't quite the same, but he was a tremendous leader. So I think in 2011, you had a better defense than 2012. I don't care what the numbers say, but it really was a big loss to this Cushing. The other thing was this about 2012. I said they were 11-1. Now they got to 11-1 and with beating Chicago on the road on a Sunday night. That was a big win for them. They had two games in which they went deep into overtime, and they were 4 days apart. On a Sunday, they played the Jags, and Matt Schaub throws for a second-best all-time 527 yards, and they were able to win on an Andre Johnson touchdown, catch and run, late in OT. Then they play the Thanksgiving game at Detroit, and they go deep into overtime again, and they're able to prevail. And it's really interesting to me that you played 10 quarters of football, basically, in a four-day span, because I don't think the team was ever quite the same after that.
No.
I think that kind of wore them out. They got a win over Tennessee, I think, the next time out, but then you had the Patriots game, and they just weren't as good as they were earlier in the year, just plain and simple. And then you look at what happened the following year. They start out 2-0, but they had to go really deep into those games. They'll win at the buzzer, and they'll win in overtime to beat San Diego and Tennessee, respectively. And then they lose 14 in a row, and it changed everybody's lives because you had a new coaching staff come in, Schaub left, the franchise flipped over, and now you had the Bill O'Brien era begin. So it's fascinating to me to study what went down late in 2012 when you lost 3 out of 4 and it just started to spiral out of control. I remember saying to somebody, because even though they won those first two games in 2013, I remember saying to somebody, the Texans have been down double figures in, it was something like 6 of the last 8 games going back to 2012. This is after the 2-0 start in 2013. I remember saying that they've been down a lot, like trailing, and they had to rally. And what's wrong? They're just not quite the same. And they weren't. And clearly, I picked up on something because they had lost 14 in a row after that. And like I said, everybody's lives had changed, no question.
I remember that that 2-14 campaign particularly well myself. I mean, that was the first year I moved to the States at that point. That was when I first started to really watch the Texans and watch football, and that was a bit of a shock for me to see them sort of fall apart so quickly. But something that you bring up there that I think is very interesting is obviously you mentioned the importance of Andre Johnson, obviously Graham Cushing we've mentioned before, TJ Yates has come up a few times as well. All three of them are now on the coaching staff for the Texans. How much do you think these experiences, these losses, these being sort of beaten down over the years, how much do you think that might actually help them in terms of preparing this team now for the season to come?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think when you talk to players, they shake a lot of that stuff off, or they use it as motivation, you know? So I think Andre Johnson, it's sad to me that he never got a chance to play in a Super Bowl or go deeper into the playoffs.
Definitely.
The other thing that's sad about Andre Johnson is that he's never been able to, and it's not his fault at all, but he's never been a high touchdown catch guy. He has a lot of catches in his career, a lot of yards, but not a lot of touchdowns. His high mark in touchdowns in a season is 9. And DeAndre Hopkins has been in the end zone an awful lot. And I just think that a lot of it was because he had Arian Foster. When the offense really started to get good in the Kubiak era and Arian Foster was running well, they would hand off to Foster a lot. He scored a lot of touchdowns. He was a great red zone runner, and Kubiak relied on that. For whatever reason, Kubiak would not throw a lot of fades and things like that to Andre Johnson, who's perfectly capable of catching them. So I don't really know. That'd be a good question for Kubiak.
Yeah.
He might have felt like he wants to control the game on the ground or whatever. They had an excellent line. I mean, in 2011 and 2012, the line was phenomenal, especially 2011. That was the best line they've ever had.
Yeah.
So I just look at Andre's career, and as well as it went, it's with sadness that he wasn't able to play at the highest level in terms of, you know, caliber of game, AFC Championship game, Super Bowl, and I hope Hopkins can do it, because his career, it's not like he was in, you know, entering the league yesterday. This is 2013. That was his rookie season. So he's been around the block a little bit now, going into year 7. So but having these guys, I think, is great. I think it's great for Bill O'Brien, because these players have played recently, so they can tell him, listen, this is working well for the players. Maybe you want to take a look at this, the practice schedule, whatever. They know what it feels like, so they can tell the coach, you know, what the players are going through on a day-to-day basis, week-to-week basis. And it works the other way, too. They can relate to the players. Since it's been so recent for them, they can actually convey the messages of the coaching staff in a really effective way, a way the players will get, and they'll have great credibility with the players. So having these guys around, I think, is really valuable for this team.
One of the things I picked up there, in particular from what you mentioned, was Kubiak's sort of insistency to some extent on relying on the run game, because Arian Foster was so strong, so dominant at that point in time, the offensive line was so good. Do you see some sort of similarities between Kubiak and O'Brien in that regard, in their determination to use the run game? Despite the fact, obviously, the O-line's not as good as it was now. Mm-hmm. Do you see some sort of similarities there?
Well, with Kubiak, you know, running that zone game, you have to be able to run to throw. And everything looks the same. And you run all those bootlegs, and the play action is so effective. O'Brien really does have this game plan offense where you will see some zone runs, but you'll see some drive blocking, and he'll adjust based on what he thinks the matchup is going to give him or what he can exploit. But in terms of general philosophy of wanted to control the game on the ground. Gary Kubiak does like to run the ball, yes, and so does Bill O'Brien. They enjoy running the football. Yeah, they want to throw it, don't get me wrong. And the offense with Kubiak, when you look at 08, 09, 2010, I mean, they were top three in offense those years. They were really throwing it. They were running it. They were doing everything. They were moving the ball very well. With Bill O'Brien, I think with Deshaun Watson, you're seeing an offense that can really be explosive. He's just had to deal with the injuries. You know, Watson, in his rookie year during that six-game stretch, it was unbelievable. Once you got through that Bengals game where they had no tight ends, they exploded. And then last year, I think what you were looking at is Watson banged up, playing with the bruised lung. Let's control the game a little bit more. Yeah, he threw for 4,000 yards, so that's not a slouch number at all. And Watson ended up with the highest QB rating in the history of the team over the course of a season, even more than Matt Schaub's rating in 2009 when he led the league in passing. So I think that the offense is going to be really good here. They just have to get things squared away up front, and we'll see how they do. But, yeah, both guys do like the run, and I don't blame them. I mean, to me, if I'm a coach, yeah, I want to throw the football. You have to throw to score. I mean, you have to be able to throw the football effectively. But to run means the clock is going. It's very healthy for your football team. Your offensive line is firing. Those guys love it. And you just, you know, Arian Foster and Bill O'Brien, they had a good year together, so to speak, in 2014. But, you know, he hasn't had a back like that since. I like Lamar Miller. I think Lamar Miller is a really good running back. But Arian Foster is an elite runner. Yeah. When healthy, he was really something to watch.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, here's the question then. I mean, looking forward, obviously, it's been a long time since that first playoff berth. There's been a lot of changes, obviously, since then. It was quite some time ago now. The Texans have an improving, we hope at least, defensive line. Their running back situation is changing a little bit with Dante Foreman coming back from injury. How do you see their run game entering this year? Are you expecting improvements? Are you expecting more production from the backs this year?
I think with Foreman looking good in the OTAs, now OTAs are not a big deal.
No.
We all know that. They're not using pads. But the way he's moving is very encouraging. You know, now that the Achilles injury is well over a year and a half behind him, I think that means that he's ready to come back and be who he was, or who he, you know, pick up where he left off when he was looking good against Arizona that afternoon when he got hurt. And not only that, but pick up at a better spot where, okay, he's gone through the rehab. He's lived some life now. He's older. He's more mature. Not that he was immature, but he's more mature. He's just more of a pro. He's seen NFL football from the sideline, knows how special it is to be out there. I think he's going to be good for this team. So between he and Miller, and Miller's a good back. You know, we saw Miller pop one for 97 yards last year. He had the best yards per carry average of his Texans career last year. So I think between Miller and Foreman, you'll have a good ground game. They got to figure out a way to supplement them, though, because you always need more than two. You know, we used to say you need more than one. Now you need more than two. Look at the Patriots. It feels like they have five running backs that they can go to. It just feels that way. Yeah, and look how beneficial it was to them and how beneficial it will be to them this year. You have to look at that model a little bit. Now, the Texans have a lot of weapons, but again, if you're not able to run it, you're going to expose the quarterback. It's not going to be good. So let's just see how those two guys do. I think a lot of it's going to depend. You know, clearly it's so obvious to say a lot of it will depend on how the line performs. But this is going to be interesting. You know, they got some new pieces to plug in there, and I think you're going to have a very compelling starting five there. They're going to generate a lot of attention, a lot of scrutiny. We'll see how they do. They have a very tough opener against New Orleans. You know, you're in a loud building. Game one, Monday night, absolute craziness. Saints in their first action following the NFC Championship game debacle. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing. We're all going to watch it and be excited about what's happening.
It is certainly going to be an extremely exciting game. But, yeah, you mentioned, obviously, the Texans. They've got two backs that we can pretty much assume at this point in time will make the eventual roster. But that third spot is a bit interesting. And I remember debating this with some of my colleagues yesterday. We've got Damari Crockett, Karen Higdon, who both came in undrafted this year. You've got Buddy Howell, obviously, is there as well. Josh Ferguson's in the mix as well. Is there, I mean, even you could even throw in the fullback they drafted in the seventh round, Colin Gillespie. I mean, is there one back at this point in time that you think is standing out, or is it a case of it's sort of all going to come down to training camp at the end of the day?
you know, Crockett has a look about him. He looks like an NFL back that, you know, could possibly do some damage. I'm not sure. Galaspia is a mystery to me. Like, you know, he's a 12th man. He plays special teams. I think that one thing that appealed to them, not only his leadership skills and a great locker room guy, all that stuff, and it looks like he could play special teams, is that he was faster than they thought he would be. And that's why he got drafted. He's got some speed for his size. He's not a prototypical fullback, and they didn't even have a fullback on the roster last year. So I don't think you'll see him getting carries, but I think he could enter the game as an H-back kind of guy, maybe get some catches. I haven't necessarily seen that specifically yet, but I'm eager to see how that all shakes out with him. But Crockett has a lot of speed. Crockett has this NFL body type. And Ferguson is fast, and Ferguson's a real pro. So I'm thinking that this is going to be, you know, I think you and your buddies having this conversation. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that shakes out for that third spot, because you know you use it, you know you need it, you know you need a guy, a spot starter maybe, or a guy to absorb some carries in a game, particularly if there are injuries or whatever. So let's see how they plan this with the roster. I can tell you this, whoever the third back is, better play special teams. You know, that's what it's going to be. You have to be versatile. You have to play a fourth down. You got to find a way out to the field. Buddy Howell's not going to get carries. You know, I talked to Buddy. I interviewed him, and he knows his role. If he makes the team, it's because he's an outstanding special teamer. If he might get carries in the preseason, but, you know, he's in all likelihood not going to get carries in a regular season game. He wouldn't shy away from one, but he knows that he stays on the roster because he's flying downfield making plays on special teams.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Then you obviously mentioned Buddy Howard's not someone to look for in that position, and we have a somewhat clearer idea of what's going to be going on at running back. But at tight end, I mean, we've got four players there. It looks like all of them could easily make the roster. Darren Fells, I really like as even almost an extra lineman, to be perfectly honest. He's a very good blocker. Akins and Thomas are both young, but certainly have a good upside. Then you've got Waring as well. And it's a difficult one. Do you think they're going to keep all four tight ends on the roster? And if so, can you see them possibly using someone like Akins, maybe as an H-back as well, like Galaspia?
I don't know about Akins that's in that role. I think it's some... Maybe in some instances, Akins and Thomas are locks to me. Waring is such a compelling athlete, and really just, you know, even going to the rookie camp, you just see him and you're thinking, this guy looks like a player.
Yeah.
So those three are going to be fun to watch. Fells is such a pro, and he's a great blocker. He's an emergency tackle. If, you know, you only dress seven offensive linemen, so God forbid you lose two guys in a game, you're down to five, and then what happens? He's a guy who can, you know, fill in there if you absolutely had to do it. You don't want to have to do it. But he's such a pro. I think Fells is going to make it interesting. I've had this debate with people. Do they keep four tight ends? Well, you're going to lose a spot somewhere else, right? So Waring's going to play special teams, maybe Akins as well. I don't know about Fells. But you have to be able to play special teams. I mean, how else can you keep four tight ends? So that's going to be interesting. And then where do you sort of factor in Galaspia? Because now if you keep it four tight ends, are you keeping four running backs? If you call Galaspia a running back, I mean, that's getting a little tight. Because the receiver group looks pretty deep to me.
Yes.
Potentially, anyway. You know, you have your first three guys, which if they stay healthy, they're going to be one of the best, you know, trios in the league.
Absolutely.
But then you have Vincent Smith, who showed you signs last year, and you got a lot of these interesting rookies like Johnny Dixon, you know, Floyd Allen. I like these guys. You know, we'll see how they do in training camp and when, you know, when you play these preseason games. But I think they're going to have some luxury problems here trying to put together a 53-man roster.
I couldn't agree more. I completely agree with that sentiment. I do think that they have, if anything, a very good problem on their hands. But looking ahead to this year's campaign and even possibly beyond that, I mean, do you think there are any, obviously we know about the offensive line problems over the last year or so. The defensive backfield had some issues last year as well. Are there any spots you think they need to address sooner rather than later in order to make that jump to finally make the push for, say, an AFC championship game?
Well, address, I mean, they're just going to try to get everybody up to speed. I don't know about talent acquisition at this point, because anybody you get, let's say you want to go out and get a corner, Well, it's not easy because no one's going to want to give up their assets right now with the season upon us when they don't know who's hurt in training camp, who's healthy. So you have those things to consider. I think corner is interesting because you signed Bradley Roby, you drafted Lonnie Johnson, you drafted people who can help you, but can they help you right away? Can they help you have a Superdome on Monday Night Football? You know, so you're wondering about those things, and I think that corner is definitely a spot to watch out for. They've got a lot of questions to answer right there, and I know the coaches will be sorting that out during camp. Who's going to play in the slot? Is it going to be Aaron Colvin coming back after a disappointing season in which he was banged up a lot? Or is it going to be somebody like Brian Body Calhoun who comes over from Cleveland? He's got a lot of ability, but can he hold down that spot on a consistent basis? I don't know. We'll see. So they've got a lot of questions to answer. But one thing I like about them is they have a lot of options. You know, they drafted people. They brought in some people. Yeah, they didn't bring in guys who are going to blow up the marquee and get you a ton of clicks on the internet. But they brought in some people who could help. So let's just see. I do believe they'll find a way to be better in the secondary than they were. And that's saying something because Kareem had a good year for them last year, and Tyrann Mathieu was good.
Certainly.
But I like Tashaun Gibson at safety. You know, so I like their safety situation. Justin Reed's a really good player. And, you know, I like having Gibson around. And I think that Adai, who they brought in from San Diego, is somebody who you can't ignore either. In a dime situation, he could find his way on the field and maybe more than that. So they do have options. It's kind of like the offensive line. You know, when I look at the secondary, especially a corner, they have a lot of questions, but they have a lot of options. So let's just see how it all plays out during camp here. And they're going to try to mix and match and find the right combinations. And hopefully they click, because on paper, you can't say definitively, oh, yeah, they're fine. They're going to have to find a way to be fine, you know?
Absolutely. So here's the big questions I know a lot of Texans fans are asking about at this point in time. Can you see Houston possibly making an AFC Championship game or a Super Bowl within the next, let's say, 3 years?
Well, they have a quarterback. And I think when you have the quarterback, you have a chance just about every year, right? As long as you have a decent team around him. I mean, the funny thing about the Patriots, you know, we always compare everything to the Patriots because they're the Patriots. But everyone's criticizing the receivers. People are criticizing the losses they've taken in the front office. People are criticizing that, this, and the other thing. Yet, when I ask people, well, who's your AFC favorite? Patriots, you know, because they have Brady and they have the culture,
yeah.
You know, and that really helps out. So if you have a quarterback and the culture, you've got a great chance to do stuff every year. Now, it really went badly for the Texans in the playoff game. I just think they were out of gas. There are no excuses. But I believe when they get back to that situation again, they'll take much better advantage of it and be ready to go. The problem for the Texans is that the AFC South looks like it's probably the toughest division in football.
Yes.
It's certainly in the conversation. Everybody looks like they got better. But the good thing, as I say that, is I look at everybody else's schedule, and they're all playing the same schedule. The Texans just have the Patriots at home. But the Colts have to go to Pittsburgh and to go everywhere the Texans are going virtually. And that is that's going to be tough for them. It's going to be tough on Houston. It's going to be tough for everybody. That's this year. But, you know, your question was about 3 years. I think with Watson, there's always a shot. This guy's special. You know, there was a local debate here. Did he have a good season or a great season last year? How would you define the season? Well, look, you know, bruised lung. The line is a little leaky. He had some issues trying to avoid people in the backfield because, I mean, there was a lot of traffic back there. He's trying to make plays, and he made a ton of plays.
Yep.
He had a great season. I mean, that's how I'll define that, because you have to take a lot of things into consideration. And they won 11 games, second most all-time in franchise history, including a 9-game winning streak. So I don't care who you're playing. That's a nice thing to have on your resume. I think Watson's tremendous, and he's just getting started. You know, he's going to have his 23rd start. Just look at it that way. You know, I mean, well, I mean, I shouldn't put it that way. Yeah, I think that's the number. He has 16 plus. Yeah, so his 23rd start on opening day, and he's 23 years old. Think about that for a moment.
Absolutely, and also, I mean, let's keep in mind he was coming back from an injury as well. Yes, he had the punctured lung, obviously, during the season as well, which obviously was a big hindrance to him. And yet he still managed to rack up over 4,000 passing yards and 500 rushing yards, first quarterback to do so. I mean, that says a lot about him. And now coming from a full offseason where he's fully healthy again, with a healthy receiving core once again, with obviously Kiki now back to full strength and Fuller slowly improving. Vincent Smith's obviously improving as well, second year in the system. I'm really excited about this Texans offense, personally, I must admit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. When you look at, say, the Miami game before Fuller goes out, they are lighting them up. I mean, no one can deal with Fuller when he's healthy.
No.
And he was really taking his game to another level as a route runner. You know, he's not just a burner, as you know. He's a shifty route runner, and Hopkins is a one-on-one nightmare. And if he gets doubled, forget about it, because QT, when he's out there, look at what he did to the Colts twice.
Exactly.
They don't want to see him. So if you have just – forget about everything else. Just have those three guys. Now we're looking at a nightmare for the defense. I just think there's a lot of pluses here. I know that a lot of the AFC – the rest of the AFC South is all very dangerous. Tennessee can beat anybody any game. Jacksonville with Foles should be better. Indy just keeps on getting better. But let it play out, because how many times in sport – I love this about sports. Everyone assumes that if something happened once, it's going to happen again and again and again. You can't assume that ever. So let's just see. This league is so even. You know, you just have to stay healthy. You hope your quarterback makes the plays. And if you have a good one, just, you know, ride him. See how it goes.
So I like to close out by throwing my guests off a little bit off topic. And with that in mind – with the NFL Combine heading to Germany this year, the NFL Academy is now running in the UK, and of course Houston will be heading to London for the first time this season. Can you see a playoff game or even a Super Bowl one day being held abroad? And if so, where?
Well, I think if a Super Bowl is held abroad, it's London. I think if London gets it. If it's going to happen, it's going to be London, right?
I'd agree with you there, definitely.
You know, they've put in the time. You know, they put in the time in London, having four games a year. You have a mini season going on there. I would love to see a team there sometime. I mean, I think it's probably easier, for lack of a better word, to the NBA if they threw a division in Europe. You get a four teams in Europe, and you can really make it go. And I think in that sport, it would be a lot, quote, easier until you get the playoff time. But for me, to have a Super Bowl over there, it means so much to the economy. You know, we had the last one here following that 2016 campaign, and it was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
I love the Super Bowl in this town. And I've been part of the two most recent ones, obviously not the one in 1973, but the one following 03 and the one following 16. Just really tremendous, because it's such a boost to your town's morale, the economy, all of it. It's hard for me to see them moving that away from the United States. There's just too much demand to have it here. But I'm not going to write it off. I mean, I think this can be an international game. I know in many ways it is already. I think London's been terrific. Germany, there's so many fans there. NFL Europe, I mean, that's the one country that really made it in. But, you know, we'll see. It's a difficult game because – it's not like you can just play it. So you can play flag football pretty easily, and I coach that with my kids. But you can't just like play tackle football out of the gate. Like, all right, let's play some tackle football. And, you know, basketball, you can just pick it up. Soccer, those sports are a little bit different. So we'll see how it goes. But they're working hard to try to get the game to as many people as possible.
And actually, if I can squeeze in one more question, just out of curiosity, sure. The Texans are one of the few teams in the NFL now that don't have any European players on their roster. I mean, the Browns have now got two or three at this point in time. You're looking at the Ravens, they've got one. The Panthers have got one, and so on and so forth. How long do you think it'll be until we possibly see one of the players come through the pathway to, let's say, the Texans pick up one of those extra practice squad spots for an international player, or they just sign one on the roster? How long do you think that might take?
I think that's just pure coincidence, you know. I don't know if there's an effort to do that. We had a player who played college football in Mexico early on in the history of the franchise. It was Antonio Rodriguez, I believe his name was, and he had a big contingent of fans at training camp. It was great, but there was no way he was going to make the team. And back then, I think you had a couple of international players in camp. You had a couple of free spots for them. It was kind of a cool thing. So maybe if they do something like that. Now, they do have an announcer. That would be me. I was born in the Netherlands. So they have a little European representation, but it's not really on the field.
And I'm from the UK. My mother's from the Netherlands. So yeah, absolutely. The Texans are becoming more and more an international team, let's say. Mark, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Where can our listeners find you on social media?
At Texans Voice on Twitter is the best way. And we do shows all the time, and I tweet those out so you can listen to Texans Radio at Texans Voice. And I really appreciate the visit.
Thank you very much for speaking to us. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've been your host for the day, Anthony Wood. Follow me on Twitter at ARWoodNFL. And of course, keep up to date with everything Texans at the Texans Wire of USA Today. Thank you very much for listening.